Well, good morning. It's 11 o'clock on a Thursday, March the 6th, here at WFERLP South Royalton. It's time for Green Zine. I played a version of this song. Definitely has an environmental bent based on activities years ago in the Sunshine State of Florida. Stay tuned. We've got Bella coming in, Thermal Networks, Henry calling in with his chainsaw. It's going to be a busy Green Zine.
Ever since the days of old, men would search for wealth untold. They'd dig for silver and for gold, and they'd leave the empty holes. They'd lay down south in the Everglades, where the black water rolls and the sawgrass waves. The eagles fly and the otters play in the land of the Seminole. Oh, blow, Seminole wind, blow like you're never gonna blow again. Calling to you like a long-lost friend, 'cause I know who you are. Blow, blow from Okeechobee, way up to Micanopy. Blow across the home of the Seminole, the alligator and the gar. Progress came and took its toll, and in the name of flood control, they made their plans and they drained the land, and now the blades are going dry. Last time I walked in the swamp, I sat down on a cypress stump, listened close and I heard the ghost of a seagull cry. Like a long lost friend, I know who you are. Blow, blow from Okeechobee, way up to Micanopy. Blow across the home of the Seminole, the alligator and the gar.
Well, that's the third version I know, and I see some country versions of that song. Got to find out who wrote it. I always thought that Donald the Buffalo wrote it, but I have a feeling it existed before they recorded it. Of course, that was JT, James Taylor, with his cover of Seminole Wind. You are tuned to Green Zine here at Free Vermont Radio, Royalton Community Radio, environmental radio of the people, by the people, and for the people. Hopefully you will think that this is one of our right up there. Interesting shows. Henry is going to join us in just a moment, but we couldn't do this type of all-volunteer, non-commercial radio, all staffed by your friends and neighbors, without the help of our generous underwriters, who include here, if I turn the page over, want to give proper attribution, they include the White River Partnership. They're actually, I think, our newest underwriter. Thank you very much, Mary. Robin Reynolds on board Daybreak's Glass Teaching Studio. Also, the Royalton Memorial Library. Might be paying a visit there a little bit later today. The Tunbridge General Store, Mountain Folk, Scan VT. I did get a chance to visit with that underwriter, Brenda, up there off of the Rochester, off the Camp Brook Road. And I think that covers just about everybody. Now, I don't know if you're done with that chainsaw. I think the guy with the hat might need it back, Henry. Yeah. Are you there?
I'm here. Yep. Yes, I'm not done with that chainsaw.
you got started with it,
though. I have two chainsaws. I have a little electric one, and I have a big gasoline one. And the little electric one was going to be an hour getting that tree out of the road.
So you got to go fossil fuels, huh? Uh-oh.
I will get my gasoline one out and get it functioning so that I can cut that up. Yes. For the listeners, I have a tree across my driveway, so I had planned to be in the studio today, but I am calling in.
Yeah, when's the last time you had that gas-fired chainsaw fired up, Henry?
Well, I ran it last summer, but it wasn't the carburetor needed cleaning then. I actually have a backup carburetor for it.
Oh, okay. So well, you're no problem.
Trade carburetors.
Everybody wanders around with a backup carburetor. Yeah.
Put that one in my ultrasonic cleaner and clean that one out.
Well, good luck with that, Henry, because we don't want you to be stranded up there for the entire weekend.
There could be forever. Who knows?
maybe that's the way you want it to be. Anyway, you're on
three.
So Henry calling in from a different location today because when he's not here, and we love it when he's here, and he was planning to be here, but he often calls in from Burlington. But he's calling from the highlands of Tunbridge, and glad to have you on the air, Henry. Our guest is in the studio, but let's take care of some other business before we introduce Bella. What do you want to start off with today?
Well, let's go right to Bird Note.
Okay.
I don't know the lyrics to that song, but it sounds to me like it's a seminal wind.
Yes.
I'm wondering if that's a reference to the winds that we are feeling buffeting us around, and maybe the winds we felt buffering us around last night. It was mighty windy up here.
Yeah.
For a couple of hours in the early nighttime.
Well, they would have had to come a long way because the Seminole wind takes place in Florida, and I think our wind directions last night were not from the south or southeast. But indeed, yes, yeah, some heavy winds. I know at above 3,000 feet yesterday, there was a report of possible 50-mile-per-hour gusts not too far from here. So, but today, a lot calmer as I look out the window, and it feels kind of spring-like here. Yep.
Yes, my driveway went from snow and ice to being fairly much like the bare ground with big puddles in it.
Yeah, there you go. Well, mud season, let's see. We haven't had as many phases yet of mud season, so maybe only number two coming in. Yep.
So just commenting on the winds of our times, recent episode, last episode of Vaults got into all of the government, what could be clawed back and what couldn't be. And it was quite an interesting program with this is for climate change legislation. And the feeling was that the electric car rebates for purchasing a car might go away, but the ones for renting a car are taken by whoever is renting it to you, and those will probably stay. So there probably will be discounts for electric cars if you wish to be buying a new one or getting a rental, a one on lease, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And the other thing they commented on was all of the investments in infrastructure having to do with ramping up battery manufacture and solar panel manufacture, that those things heavily apply in red states. And the feeling is there will be quite a lot of pushback from them to not allow those things to be clawed back.
Yeah, you know, and just to kind of go, we know there's a trade war underway between at least four places, and we're at the epicenter because we started it, or I should say our current government started it. So Mexico, Canada, and China. That it, ironically, although this is certainly not the intent of the current administration, but if you were looking around for renewable energy investment where you thought there may be some significant growth, I would say U.S.-based solar panel manufacturing, in that China is the dominant player in that field. And now with the price, I forget what the tariff on that specific item will be, but it's gonna really reduce the amount of panels coming into this country from China. And there are U.S. manufacturers. They're very small, but they could ramp up. And, you know, there's maybe, I don't know. I'm not a big patriot kind of person, but hey, you know, buy U.S., buy local, etc. So just a little bit of a sidelight on that. And we'll probably maybe touch once again on EVs towards the end of Green Zine here.
Yeah. So I think solar panels, that was also covered in this last Volt show.
And okay.
I think that there are some substantial producers of solar panels in the United States. And the goal in all of the U.S. subsidies is to get those vital industries not to be dependent on a foreign source, especially a foreign source that we aren't sure whether they're going to play fair game with us. And so it's to drive production up to a level where we're cost competitive with the rest of in solar panels with the Chinese market. Chinese market presently has a glut of solar panels on it.
Right.
So the previous week's Volts discussed how Pakistan could buy such cheap solar panels, being that it was a neighbor of China,
uh-huh.
and they were so cheap that people were just throwing them up as fences around their houses and not worrying about which direction they were headed for, and just connecting them all up and getting themselves electricity for their houses.
Well, you know, just on that, as far as a third country being involved, there was a story about Vietnam possibly being a pass-through country for Chinese goods that then would be rebranded as being from Vietnam, or maybe in this case of Pakistan. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering here, and hopefully this trade war, as they call it, is not going to last very long. But it doesn't look good. And we're not an economics show, so we'll have to check in on that. How about if we check in with our feathered friends here on Bird Note, Henry?
Yes.
All right.
Well, we've had I chose this one because we've had quite a lot of crows in our backyard, and we've actually gotten them to pay attention to the food we put out and start looking for it and interacting with us some. So
all right.
This is about the difference between ravens and crows.
Yeah.
These were mighty big crows. So yeah. We were trying to figure out whether they could be ravens.
All right, let's go to Bird Note. You're listening to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio.
This is Bird Note. So you're walking down the street, and a trash can's been tipped over, and eagerly picking through the riches strewn across the sidewalk are several black birds. They're crows. Or ravens. No, definitely crows. Maybe? How can you tell the difference? Well, first off, listen. Crows caw, while ravens croak. And while common ravens and American crows look quite similar, there are a few ways to tell them apart. Ravens are larger, and they often travel in pairs. Crows usually hang out in larger groups. Next, try to get a look at the bird's tail. A crow's tail feathers are basically all the same length, so its tail opens like a fan. But a raven has longer middle feathers in its tail, so it looks more like a wedge or a triangle. By far, though, the best way to tell these two birds apart is to look at their bills. The crow has a modest bill, but the raven has a great big chunky-looking beak that pretty much says, "Yeah, that's right, I'm a raven." Ravens tend to stick to the wilder parts of the world, like woodlands and open spaces. But when you're walking past those trash cans, you're probably seeing crows. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
And Bird Note is a regular feature here each week on Green Zine. Hey, Henry, I was thinking of this guy, and then when he did that voice with the raven, do you remember the old? Yeah. Do you remember the old Schnozzola?
Yeah, that's what it went back to that for me too.
Yeah. Actually, his initials, unlike the guy that went skiing up here recently, is JD. Huh? Have you got it, Henry?
Yes.
Well, tell us.
It's.
I won't put you on the spot, Jimmy Durante.
Yeah.
Reaching way back. In fact, looking at this bill, it does look, this raven does look a little bit like Jimmy Durante. I haven't thought about him in quite a while.
He had I think he must have been in a fist fight early in his life and broken his nose.
He may have been. All right. We digress a lot here. Hey, Bella is here. Do you think we should get into our main topic of the day
so that
she can get back to her billable hours? Yeah, we want to make sure that she gets paid. Not here by the radio station. Nobody gets paid, by the way, Bella, just so you know. I'm going to turn her microphone.
We can never do it if it was paid.
No, we wouldn't be able to do it for 12 years. Anyway, I'm going by memory on this. Let's welcome Bella O'Connor to the station.
Yes.
Okay. I was thinking maybe it was O'Connell, and we did have a programmer whose last name was O'Connor. And Bella, great to have you here. I met you maybe a month ago or so at the volunteer fair at Tunbridge.
Yes, that's right. So happy to connect.
Yeah, and we want to thank Sylvie Desitel for helping us connect, because I think both of you guys are involved in 350VT.
Yes, definitely.
All right. So we're going to be talking about thermal networks, but let's hear a little background from you as far as your interest in all things environmental, agriculture, or whatever it is, and how you ended up at the law school and what you're up to now.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for your introduction. It's great to be here. My name is Bella O'Connor. I'm an attorney, and I've just been a lifelong environmental activist who was very interested in attending law school to help maybe change some of the systems that really perpetuate a lot of the environmental harms that are happening in our world today. So I moved here to South Royalton several years ago to go to Vermont Law and graduate school. I was an environmental mission scholar. And essentially, my concentration is in animal law. So the majority of my professional work really centers around animal protection issues, really with a special focus on industrialized animal agriculture and the intersections of how that harms animals, harms the environment, harms people, things of that nature. But I'm also very, very interested in energy law, in climate change and law, and all of the different interesting things happening there. So when I was a law student, I started volunteering with the group 350 Vermont, which is, really part of a larger organization called 350. But of course, I just volunteer with the local White River node, and that's where I met Sylvie and Chris and so many other wonderful activists. So I really started getting involved in local climate justice work, and that's where I really learned about thermal energy networks and became very passionate about that.
Wow. That was a pretty quick synopsis of a whole lot of things going on. And you mentioned animal law, and that's what I saw recently, a photo of a factory farm. And in that article, it might have been in the Valley News, you were mentioned in there. Yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. So I'll be presenting a talk at Bethel University. No one has signed up yet, so maybe we'll recruit.
Well, you've got time.
But tell some attendees. Well,
yeah, what's the subject and what's the date so people could... sign up.
Yeah, sure. I'm embarrassed to say I don't even know off the top of my head. You'll have to go to the Bethel University website.
I have it. I will get it before the end of the show. I do. Yep.
Great. So I do in my personal life a lot of public speaking recently, just about the relationship between CAFOs, And for anyone who doesn't know, that's a concentrated animal feeding operation, aka like factory farms. And so I sort of just talk about the ways that CAFOs are very, very poorly regulated, and how we really ought to do a lot of work at the state, local, and federal level to do a better job of protecting animals, the environment, and of course, people who are tremendously harmed by that work. So so the catalyst of all of this was about last year I was invited by a local animal rights group, essentially, and panel called Compassionate Brattleboro, where I sort of spoke about ways that we can enhance compassion sort of in our local community and talked about, you know, of course, CAFOs there. And then a lot of people became just very interested in educating themselves about it and sort of the intricacies of animal law and policy. And so, yeah, I've sort of made a little side project for myself out of that and do a lot of speaking about those issues.
Excellent. And I have scrolled through Bethel University. I did not get a degree, but I see your program here, Fighting Factory Farms, Pathways to Progress. And don't make other plans now, Bella. Wednesday night, March 26th. So you got a little bit of time at 6:30. And folks, if you want to find out about the rest of the programs, we might have mentioned a few more as the month goes along. There are a number of them that are involved with sustainability, resilience, and the environment as part of Bethel University. But today we're here to talk about something that maybe a lot of our listeners are not as familiar with, and that's thermal networks. So let's jump in. Maybe, Henry, do you have an opening comment or question on that subject?
Yeah, I think we need to get Bella to describe what a thermal network is. It sounds like something from science fiction or from the Boiler Room or something.
Yeah, I'm all ears.
Great. So we can just go ahead and jump in. I found in my personal experience that thermal energy networks can be challenging to explain without a photo. So if any point you need to stop me, please interrupt. But essentially, a thermal energy network is a lesser known form of renewable energy. Essentially, it's an umbrella term, really, that just describes any form of geothermal technology that uses water via a pipe to capture, reuse, and then share thermal energy, aka heating and cooling, between buildings. So you're probably thinking, what does that mean at all? So in short, a thermal energy network, or a TEN for short, as many people call it, in order to understand how they work, you really only need to understand one simple principle, which is that no matter what the temperature of the air is, the temperature beneath the earth remains constant. It's always the same. So here in New England, whether it's 80 degrees outside or 8 degrees outside, the temperature beneath the earth's surface, 6 feet and below, is always going to be between 55 and 60 degrees Fahrenheit. And so what a lot of folks don't know, and what I certainly didn't know until maybe 2 years ago, was that you can actually harness that temperature and use it for heating and cooling. So does that kind of make sense so far?
It does to me. I know that that circulatory function of, I'm assuming, the piped water going down into that temperature and then being able to move it around, because water moves pretty easily, and capture that extra heat's there. I guess what maybe I don't get is, for cooling purposes, where it's 80 degrees outside and yet that below surface temperature is still between 55 and 60, how that would help do cooling.
Yeah, sure, sure. So let's kind of get into the specifics of that. So essentially, how all of the pipes function is you lay them beneath the earth, just like the gas or water pipes that we already have beneath our streets. And these pipes are all connected to different buildings in a network. So you can kind of imagine maybe the own street that you live on, and imagine that you and all of your neighbors have pipes running beneath your home, that they're all connected to each other. So now imagine that each person has a pump in their home, maybe in their basement. And essentially, how that pump runs is you can press a button and that makes the water in those pipes move. So it's not stagnant, it's flowing water, as you mentioned. And so as the water flows, it's getting warm because it's being exposed to that warm water from the ground. And then, of course, what happens is that that water goes up through the pipe, it connects to the pump, and that pump converts the kinetic energy from the heated water into hot air that blows into your home. And so essentially, what what would happen for the summer months if you're trying to do cool air is that identical compression process essentially like mimics the opposite effect. Does that, I don't know if that like makes total sense, but you're essentially taking either the cool energy or the warm energy and you're compressing it and it essentially just like blows out the air.
Mm.
So the key here is the heat pump that's in the link between that ground temperature and your house. Just like a heat pump that uses the air outside to either gather warmth for the house or cooling for the house when you're gathering warmth, you are throwing, think of it as throwing away cold. You are making mm-hmm. the air that's coming out of the heat pump colder than it was. And when you want to heat your house, you're making, when you want to cool your house, you're making the air coming out of that air source heat pump warmer.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's a very hot day, it isn't as efficient. And when it's a very cold weather in the winter, it's not as efficient if you're trying to throw away cold into what's already very cold air.
Mm.
And so the advantage to the geothermal system is that that's much closer to the temperature that you want to have the house. So you have less work to do when you're using the ground as that heat source or cool source.
So if we're looking at 55 to 60 and in the summertime, you're maybe trying to keep your house at, you know, if you're using air conditioning and a heat pump for that, maybe only going 5 or 10 degrees from that median range. And in the wintertime, you're getting temperatures from below ground that are higher than what we're used to outside. So that's really very efficient to bring things up in the geothermal. So there are certainly advantages, probably less energy used to create those ideal mm-hmm. temperatures with geothermal than with the air sourced. Would that be correct, Bill?
Yeah, that's definitely correct. So geothermal heat pumps that are ground source as opposed to the air air-sourced heat pumps that we were referring to earlier are much, much more efficient. They're probably the most efficient pumps that we have commercially available, and they require far, far less energy for sort of a wide variety of reasons. But one example would just be that they're kept inside of your home as opposed to outside of your home, right?
Yep.
But yeah.
Huh. So do we have examples of people that are experimenting with this, have it in their own homes, or actually linked networks, as you said, here in Vermont or somewhere else in the country?
Yes, definitely. So there are tons of different examples. This type of technology has been popular at a private level for people to install in their personal homes for years now. But there are lots of examples of connected networks in the New England area and in similar comparable climates, right? So like Toronto and things of that nature. So one example of a project is called Birksie Glen that's in Canada, not too far from us, where there's about 300 households that are currently enjoying reliable, sustainable local energy. And it's provides 100% of the heating and cooling needs for all of those families. And their utility costs are about 40% less than people in that same climate who use natural gas, oil, electric, things of that nature. There's also a Massachusetts utility that's installing a lot of these network geothermal operations to serve neighborhoods of, I think, around 50 homes that are also connected to schools and fire stations and things like that. So it's sort of a larger community project. And then, of course, really close to us, Champlain College here in Vermont has one on their campus. Dartmouth is installing one. And really, people, I think, are incredibly passionate about it, not only from an environmental perspective, but from an efficiency and cost perspective, which I think is why we see a lot of low-income neighborhoods and we see a lot of larger institutions being really interested in this technology now.
Yeah. Wow. So not really a conservative versus progressive divide on that. All people, whatever political persuasion, love to save money and be efficient.
Yes.
That the one that you mentioned that was 300 homes in Canada, mm-hmm. was that factored into the system as those homes were being built, or was the geothermal network hooked up with existing homes that were already there?
I couldn't say, but I know that either is possible.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can add it to the existing infrastructure of your home, or you can, if you're thinking of adding a new building or new homes in your area, that's a great opportunity to invest too.
Right, because we know just to stick with the housing situation here, there's probably going to be, you know, some small affordable housing developments built within the village envelope sometime over the next few years. Getting funding for that is very difficult, but it would seem to me there would be big cost savings. Let's say you were going to put in an eight-unit or 10-unit subdivision that was going to be right from the get-go. The pipes are buried. It's all part of the program of getting your place. That would be another potential cost savings, getting it as part of the plan before anything is built.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely right. And I guess another thing that's important to note if we're talking about things being built by a municipality or sort of at a larger level is that a lot of the infrastructure that we already have is sort of compatible with this technology. So I know in Massachusetts, there's been a huge effort to use existing gas pipes that are already installed or that maybe need to be replaced and just converting them to geothermal, right, to kind of utilize what's already there.
Recycle, so reuse, repurpose. Yeah.
Yes.
Go ahead, Henry.
So that means that they're no longer circulating gas. They're circulating water that is being used to heat and cool houses.
Yeah, it's just pure water, or especially if you live in a colder climate, right? You would mix essentially the equivalent of like antifreeze in with the water just to make sure that everything doesn't freeze up. But yeah, usually it's an entirely water-based system.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
So I think that one of the things to point out is that these are very expensive if they're done mm-hmm. for a single house.
Mm-hmm.
You can design it into the build of a house and make it make some sense, but they really become cost effective when you have a group of housing or something where there is a lot of sharing going on.
Right, exactly. So the more people that you have connected, the more effective and efficient the system is. And I think this is also one of the reasons why thermal energy networks and just geothermal energy in general, I think, didn't gain as much traction in the environmental movement, I think, early on, just because the upfront cost that you would have to have to install something like this into your home was so astronomical that it was just not affordable to the average person. But I think we really see that changing for a variety of reasons. And actually, Vermont passed a great law in the previous legislative session that I think makes these projects much more affordable to people. So we could sort of talk about that as well. But yeah, definitely huge cost savings when done in the right way.
Hmm. And tell us about kind of the using waste heat. You think about all the water that we heat up for our cooking and washing dishes and showers and washing laundry, and that goes down the drain, and it's a lot warmer than the groundwater, and it's a lot warmer than the air outside, or so if you can tap into that and cool that water off, you can capture that heat and put it back into houses. Do you have any examples of where that's being done, where they're tapping into the waste heat from the sewer system?
Off the top of my head, I don't, but I know that programs like that certainly exist. A good place to check would be the Vermont Community Thermal Networks website. So if you go to their website, they have a whole list of like almost every example where they have a 10 available in the U.S. But yeah, that's an absolutely great great point that you brought up. So yeah, there's a tremendous amount of waste heat that comes from wastewater treatment facilities that can be used. And I guess that's another benefit of the thermal energy network is when all of these buildings are connected, energy is never wasted because it can be stored underground without having to worry about like lithium ion batteries, you know, that maybe other forms of renewables are dependent upon. And you can share all of that heating and cooling with each other. So maybe another apt example would be, for example, in the South Royalton Little Town Center, we have a couple different restaurants. We have the co-op that have a tremendous amount of refrigeration and freezers, and that give off a lot of waste heat as well. And so that excess heat that's being emitted from the refrigeration, it would be so economical if we were able to really capture that and then use that to, say, heat the apartments that are above all of those facilities.
Yeah, I was just trying to imagine how many stakeholders there are on the block there. There are plenty of apartments upstairs and a number of businesses and another new business opening up pretty soon. So that sounds like a great way of sharing. Now, is that too big a stretch to connect, let's say, properties on that block to, let's say, the law school here? I mean, it's right across the street from the start of that block.
Yeah, no, not at all. No, that would be perfectly close. I mean, thermal energy networks, the closer you are, the better that they operate, right? Because you want ideally a high density area. But as we've said, there's multiple projects that involve hundreds and hundreds of homes, right? So they can really stretch as far as you'd like them to.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I've got and I'm going to let you in here, Henry. A couple questions. So love the idea of sharing. It certainly sounds a little bit like socialism to me. I like that. But, you know, people would want to set their thermostats, winter or summer, at different levels. How does one keep track of that if you're all part of a shared network of heating and cooling? And secondly, and you're a lawyer, but maybe this isn't your expertise, are there agreements that need to be signed so one homeowner says, okay, I'm going to be part of this geothermal network, and the next one says, I don't? Or as far as an agreement, how does one kind of make sure that everybody's on the same page?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I'm not sure that I would really be able to answer that, but I think that the answer probably lies within how the project is being funded, for example. So let's say you're like a small nonprofit group or something like that, or maybe just a group of people from the community, and you decide you want to build a thermal energy network. The state of Vermont, for example, now allows that group of people to seek permission from the public utilities commissions and incorporate themselves as their own utility. So they could then take money from the public utilities commission, essentially in the form of a loan, and you would pay that loan off over time, essentially like a mortgage, through the rates that people would pay each month. And I would imagine that if you want a low and comparable rate, you would create an agreement where every single person is paying the same amount each month and that everybody's home is being kept at the same temperature. Of course, what the intricacies of that truly involve, I guess I can't really be sure. But I guess also with a thermal energy network, let's say you wanted your home to be slightly warmer than maybe 75 degrees in the winter or something like that, it would be nothing that I suppose would preclude you from having other sources of heating in your home, let's say like a wood stove or something like that. But the base level for the geothermal technology would be the same, and I would imagine everyone would pay into it the same.
I mean, I'm thinking of if the thermostats were networked with each other so that, you know, some computer somewhere could say, well, this person is averaging, you know, this amount of temperature during the winter and their neighbor is there, that would be a way of allocating expenses. Mm. But yeah, what was I thinking? Are you aware that Woodstock is maybe working on a thermal network? You are aware of that.
Yeah, there's a bunch of different communities all over Vermont doing one. There's Woodstock. I think there's a group in Hartford as well. Yeah, people are very excited.
Yes, this is great. Henry?
Yeah, so I asked this question of someone else from the Vermont 350 geothermal node, and they said, well, you have to research it, but I wondered, here in the Tunbridge Village, we have individual houses have their own wells. and there's quite a line of houses with their own wells. And I know from having had a well in the village at the milk cottage that that those wells are deep and that they would have that ground temperature water. And the one that, that the milk cottage has was quite prolific. It would you could draw a lot of water from it. And I know some of the ones on the fairground are like that. And the question I had was, could you pump the water out of one well, extract the heat or the cool that you wanted for houses out of it, take that water down and down the street and dump it down a different well, and that way basically share that heating or cooling, depending on time of year, with all the houses that pipe passed. And I guess it has a lot to do with whether the wells are plentiful enough to do it, but that theoretically could be done along any main street that is currently still on wells.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. I suppose I couldn't say if, like you mentioned earlier, if one well for one home would be a sufficient source. But yeah, what you're describing is essentially called an open loop geothermal system. So the system that I was describing earlier and the system that is the most popular is a closed loop system. So there would be water that's already added to the pipes and it's spread around between the homes over and over and over again. But for example, there's a geothermal project in Burlington, actually, that I forgot to mention, and they actually tap into the aquifer there. And so they actually pull up that water. So that's, you know, certainly possible, and many people do it.
I watched them drilling the holes for that. Yeah, that's quite a large housing complex. That's a multi-story building there. And they had that well was actually an artesian well. It was running over the top once drilled it. And coming technology, are you aware of what's happening now and has been happening for a long time in places like Iceland and New Zealand, where the temperature, the inside of the earth is much closer to the surface? Would you care to talk about that a little bit and then what the future of that might be?
Sure. I mean, I suppose I don't really have much to say other than that, like, those forms of technology are absolutely incredible. I think the reason we just don't have them in more places is because geographically they don't exist everywhere in the world. So I think a 10 would kind of provide the opportunity for more people to tap into geothermal. But yeah, if you wanted to speak more about those projects, they're so, so important as well.
Yeah. So Iceland gets the majority of its household heating from just tapping into steam vents that are right there at the surface will heat houses. New Zealand generates a lot of its electricity by capturing that steam and running it through a turbine and making electricity. And there are places in the United States that can happen. But what has happened is that with the technology for fracking, for generating deep wells and making them go laterally after they got down there, drilled sideways once they got down to depth, that you can draw up heat that is enough to generate steam or even not to just generate hot water that's maybe 2 miles deep or 5 miles deep. And as that technology, that drilling technology, which has now been significantly developed because of fracking, it becomes cost effective to do that for heating. Vermont, the that that hot core of the Earth is quite deep, so we can't tap into it yet. But mm-hmm. there are many places in the United States and the West that is available.
Yeah.
And all of that is, I mean, if you go back to your using the Massachusetts example of the gas pipelines being used for moving hot water, you're not only doing it cheaper, but you're not burning fossil fuel anymore, so you aren't dumping carbon in the environment when you do that.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
So in terms of global warming, you're not only cost effective, but you're getting rid of the fossil fuel component.
Yeah, I'm trying to get my head around what I view as a very negative thing, which is the fracking that's going on for natural gas, the Marcellus Shale, I know Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and several mm-hmm. other states, that the drilling technology, and we know that they have sort of confidential records as to the type of chemicals that they use, and we could go on and on about the dangers of fracking for natural gas, but being able to use those drilling technologies, as long as they don't upset our tectonic plates down there, Henry, to bring up that heat, to turn sort of a villain of climate change into a more benign is an interesting concept. We'll see mm-hmm. if it happens over the next few years. Maybe not under the current administration.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
I think it's all about making profit for the gas and oil companies.
Might be. That may have something to do with it. Hey, we've still got a little bit of time, but let's wrap up with a couple more questions and comments. Henry, do you have anything else for Bella?
So how do people get involved? What do you recommend if people are interested and want to, I mean, we'll put up the thermal, the Vermont Thermal Network website on our notes. But do you have a suggestion if people want to get into this and actually see if something can be done in their area?
Yeah, totally. So I think the Vermont Community Thermal Network's website would be the best place to go. You could also look up 350 Vermont and find your local node. There's a lot of education that we provide about thermal energy networks, and you might find a group by where you live that's already working on these kind of projects where you can kind of tap in and get involved. I think really the resident expert in Vermont that knows about all things thermal energy networks is Debbie New. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her, but she's incredible. And a wonderful activist, and she's connected with both 350 and Vermont Community Thermal Networks. So, looking up her contact information, getting in touch with her via those mediums, and just having a conversation with her about what volunteer opportunities are available would be another wonderful way to get involved.
Future Great. Guest. Sounds we'll like put, a future guest.
We'll, yeah.
We will put up links for that. Yes, Debbie New was the person that I asked about the wells in Tunbridge. Ran that by her.
Mm-hmm. All right. So. Well, hey, really appreciate you taking the time, Bella, to come by. And once again, don't forget, I think the date in my head is Wednesday, the 26th of March. Totally different subject. Once again, let's mention what that subject is, because we have a lot of listeners that are into local ag and sustainable ag, as opposed to maybe some of the presentation that you're going to give.
Sure, yeah. So again, my talk is called Pathways to Progress, Fighting Against Factory Farms, and I'll sort of be giving a general overview about how local, state, and federal regulations in particular really fail to protect animals, the environment, and people from the many, many harms associated with factory farming. So if you're interested in learning a little bit more about the legal intricacies of that, what you personally could do about it, hopefully it won't bum you out. but please come on down.
No, your laugh is too infectious for people to get bummed out.
Okay,
no,
good.
It's not happening.
Good.
Can we spend 5 minutes talking about that and about the confinement operations that are considered organic when they're really not? Can I?
Sounds like you've
that one, yeah. Or other things you want to cover?
Well, there are some other things, but if you can keep it to like 2 minutes, Henry.
Okay.
Yeah.
So So one of the bugs that I have, and this is regulation-wise, is that in order to be an organic farm, you have to have cows on pasture. You have to, and a lot of the CAFOs say they have cows on pasture, but when you, the only time they're on pasture is when someone's coming to inspect them.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a key. So one of the problems with CAFOs, quite separate of the animal rights and whether the animals are being treated well or not, is that you are having a lot of animals in one place and all of the nutrients are being trucked into that one point, and then the manure is attempted to be carried back out and put back in those fields. But the reality is that it gets to the near fields a lot more than it gets to the far fields. And when cows are on pasture, and New Zealand does this really well, when cows are on pasture, they're distributing their own manure. and you can have a farm that is of the scale of a CAFO, but the cows have to be not all in one location in order to really make it sing.
Mm-hmm.
You have to break the cows up and not have them walk miles to the fields that they're going to.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that would be something that if we could simply hold them accountable for the regs that were there, we would have cows that got more exercise, was better for the cows, and was better for the nutrient distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good points, Henry. Very good point. Once again, I want to thank you very much for coming by, Bella, and good luck. And good luck with Bethel University. I think you'll get an advanced degree.
Well, thank you very much. It's been so wonderful chatting here with you guys.
Excellent. I'm glad we were able to put it together. You are listening to Green
thank
Zine
you
here.
For coming to Green Zine.
Yeah.
Sorry I didn't get to the studio to be there in person with you.
Plug that electric chainsaw in, Henry, and get that thing going again, and you won't have to use that carburetor. Hey, we've got about 8 minutes.
Yeah, I hate the idea of running. That's why I haven't bothered to fix the carburetor on that chainsaw, is I really don't want to use it, but this tree is going to be a long saw with an electric chainsaw.
Good luck with that. Hey, real quick to a couple of other news items here, and I'm looking at the current issue of 7 Days, just came out yesterday. And in the opening section where they have just some little snippets, Senator Peter Welch, we know that our president gave a talk to Congress the other night, and Senator Welch invited the Vermont Maple Sugar Makers Association executive director to the president's address. Mm-hmm. Sugar makers in Vermont now face a 25% tariff on Canadian equipment. We know that the maple sugar, which I think is pretty benign as far as an agricultural product and certainly one of the emblems of the state of Vermont, is definitely going to be facing some stiff costs. If you want to swing across the aisle to the other side, today in the Herald, if you want to see a conservative view that's very critical of Vermont Democrats in the legislature, there is a piece from former chair of the Vermont Republican Party, Rob Roper, entitled "Vermont Democrats Need to Fish or Cut Bait on Climate Policies." And Henry, I think you had a note about a meeting tomorrow, maybe at noon, about that subject as far as legislation and what can be done by the Climate Caucus. Did I see that in the notes?
Yes, indeed. That's in the notes. That's actually up in the notes for the show. Did that last night. That's an action you can take, is to join in on that and learn about that. And I might say that on an energy basis and the Canadian side of it, the trade war, I'm not sure where they've been applied yet, but the Canadians are talking about charging for hydropower.
Electric, I was going to say.
And they're talking about natural gas coming to Vermont. So, I'm not sure that Trump cares whether a blue state has higher prices for its energy, but it'll have quite an impact on us in Vermont if that trade war keeps ratcheting up.
And keep in mind, not only Hydro-Québec, but that the largest electricity utility in the state, Green Mountain Power, is controlled by a Canadian corporation. So you can expect your utility bills if this trade war continues to be going up significantly, not only in Vermont, but particularly here in New England. So we had some positive talk, but now we're throwing a couple of bummer curveballs in there, but we won't let it get to you. I'm just going to read a little bit from a column from Margaret Renkel, who actually covers a lot of issues here. I'm going to give you the title of the column. It appeared in the New York Times just a couple days ago. It's a opinion guest essay, Truths to Remember in a Time of Lies. And she covers a lot of territory here, but I'm just going to go to the three sections that she has about climate change and the environment. So some of the truths that she wants to point out: climate change is making natural disasters more disastrous. The world's glaciers are melting with calamitous implications for life on Earth. But the president of the United States calls climate change a hoax. Now his administration is making steep cuts to the staff of NOAA, which collects and analyzes climate data, including life-saving roles at the National Weather Service, which warns us when severe weather is headed our way. Another point that she makes: the pace of climate change is accelerating. Even so, the president is working to undo the climate resilience measures of the bipartisan Inflation Reduction Act. He has also threatened to scrap FEMA, which is already reeling from job cuts, including the loss of those who are most experienced in helping communities recover from disasters. And finally, she makes a point about renewable energy. It is cheaper than fossil fuels, but that isn't stopping the current administration from halting federal approvals for wind and solar projects or from rolling back funding allocated under the Inflation Reduction Act to speed the transition to clean energy. And he's making these cuts, as he promised big oil executives. I remember when they had that meeting last year, though his own voters, as you mentioned before, benefit from projects like these. So those are the comments of Margaret Renkel from the New York Times.
So Lauren, I'm spacing her last name, who I've been visiting with, might be a future guest, has pointed out that the Trump administration is taking down the information that's already been gathered on taxpayers' expense that has to do with climate and climate change and what's happening. They're just making it so the information isn't there anymore. And that's disturbing because it's just rewriting history, but it is disturbing because it's something we've already paid for, and yet the Trump administration doesn't want the information out there, so they're just taking it down. And there's a whole other level of immorality about that. I'm not quite sure how to express it, but
On the EV front, they're ordering the disconnection, or at least discontinuance of EV chargers that are already in place, that have already been paid for, that have already been charging vehicles, and they are currently being disabled. Right now, we are listening to music from an artist that is going to be joining Ethan Setioatan next Friday, the 14th, up at the Chandler Music Hall on the violin. This is Julian Pinelli. Henry, it is maple season. This is the Mapleton Waltz from a CD.
Hey, Waltz.
Yeah, I try to get a waltz in for you, Henry. Just don't start waltzing with bears up there with the chainsaw in your hand. That's a bad idea.
There you go.
Back to getting that tree.
Music to go in the dump by.
Indeed. And Green Zine is brought to you today by Soleflect and Bale and Royal Trailworks, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solarfest, White River Land Collaborative, and the White River Partnership. Thanks to all those entities, and thanks to you for supporting Royalton Community Radio as we get ready to do our once-a-year fund drive starting this Saturday, the 8th of March through next Friday. We hope that you can contribute, renew your membership, become a new member, make an additional donation. That would be great. Henry, always good to hang with you, and we'll look forward to being back on the air next week at 11 o'clock here on Green Scene at WFVR LP in South Royalton, Vermont.
Bye-bye.